So I've been thinking about some ways to really be better at this, to make Zen Founder an even more awesome podcast, because I think it's already pretty awesome.
We've been doing it for 10 months. We're about 40 episodes in, and frankly, we've built quite a listener base. It's been a fun experience, and we've impacted a lot of people.
And considering that, to be honest, mostly we sort of throw it together in an hour each week, we've had some really amazing feedback. I think that people are really enjoying it and that it's been really helpful to people.
Yeah, if you read the iTunes reviews, there are founders with their significant others commenting about how they're listening together. I actually think, based on our audience numbers, I bet it's like almost a 1.5 or a 2x multiplier on our audience because of the number of people who come up to us in person at conferences or who talk about in the iTunes reviews that they're listening to it with their significant other, because they say it's the podcast that they listen to that's not just about startup tactics. It's not just about applying something to their business. It's about the life and the family. You know, it's about integrating all of this and making it a cohesive picture. So I feel like we're really touching on something that is unique in our space.
I got together with a friend from graduate school today, and her husband is a dentist and runs his own practice, and he listens to every episode. So even outside of the startup space, it sounds like there's some interest in the kind of topics that we're addressing with Zen Founder.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, there are many thousands of people who are tuning in every week. From what I've heard, it's people tune in to feel like they're not alone, to feel like the stuff they're going through is quote unquote normal compared to other founder experiences. Because if you read TechCrunch and Mashable and Inc. magazine, they're not delving into the detail of it like we are, of the story of a founder and his spouse, who happens to be a psychologist and can also lend that unique ear to it.
So that brings me back to the way we began this conversation, and how do we level this up? Because honestly, I feel like there's a lot that we could do to make this better. I would like to tell stories that are more in-depth and more produced and be even more creative in the ways that we're using different voices, different narratives and music, and bringing more research and kind of more prepared material to our listeners.
Absolutely. And we've talked very specifically about some elements we could bring into the mix that would up the game. A lot of us listen to the podcasts like Startup from Alex Bloomberg, or maybe it's This American Life, 99% Invisible. Those take time and resources to produce. And I think in our ideal world, we would move more towards a model of that. Maybe we can't devote 40 hours a week, but instead of 1 hour, maybe we could devote 4 or 5, and we could up the level of production, up the level of storytelling. We could, at a certain point, if there was enough support, we could go to 2 episodes a week.
So now we're talking to you on the other end of the earbuds, headphones, car speaker. We would like to ask for your help. If this is a podcast that you really enjoy and you have found to be valuable to you and to your family, to your business, would you consider helping us to level up, helping this podcast to be even better and have a farther reach? We have set up a Patreon account where people can support our work and join the Zen Founder community.
Yeah, and it's not just about helping us. It's about producing a better podcast that you can then benefit from. And if you go to supportzenfounder.com, you'll see our Patreon page. And all a Patreon is an ongoing support that can help us level the podcast up. We have some pretty nominal goals. First one is to raise $300 a month from all of our thousands of listeners collectively. If we raise $300 a month, that will pay for professional editing. It allows both Sherry and I to invest more time into improving the show. If we hit $1,200 a month, we're committing to better storytelling, more production. It allows us to invest additional time and resources into shaping episodes, into cohesive stories that include things like the music and the narration and the spirit of Alex Bloomberg's Startup and 99% Invisible. And we have goals beyond that as well. And you can see them if you go to supportzenfounder.com. To be honest, anything you are able to contribute will help. But if you can spare the cost of, let's say, a latte each month, let's say $5, we feel like we can really blow the doors off this thing. We've delivered a new podcast episode every week for the past 40 weeks, and we hope that those have been beneficial to you. And if they have, and if you feel like you're getting value from us, we want to partner up with you and would love to have your support so that we can up our game and continue to deliver this show for you.
And we love doing it. And I feel like we could even bring more creativity and awesomeness to it with a little more time and a little bit more support from you.
So if you're thinking about it, check out supportzenfounder.com, and we hope that you'll consider supporting the show.
And now back to our regularly scheduled program.
you're going to like the way you look. I guarantee it. Does that sound familiar? It's George Zimmer, founder of The Men's Warehouse. He founded the company in 1977, and in 1985, he started appearing in the company's TV commercials. And that iconic quote, "You're going to like the way you look, I guarantee it," has been heard by millions of people over the course of 20 or 30 years. The company is still in business. It's been in business for almost 40 years, but George Zimmer was fired by the board in 2013, nearly 40 years after starting the company. In today's episode of Zen Founder, Sherry interviews George Zimmer, and she talks to him about what it was like to start this company from nothing and to build it up to an iconic brand, and what it felt like to be kicked out of his own company, and what it feels like to start anew at this late stage in the game, to basically be starting fresh on his own. And they also touch on the issue of family and work-life balance and what it's like to try to raise a family while growing a company to the magnitude that the Men's Warehouse has achieved. So it's a bit different from the topic of high-tech startups that we typically focus on, but Sherry and I felt like it was quite informational nonetheless. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Zen Founder Podcast. I'm Rob, the founder.
And I'm Sherry, the clinical psychologist. And we've come together to help founders and their families stay sane while starting up.
Each week, we'll talk about different ways to work well, stay emotionally and physically healthy, and stay connected to the people that you care about.
I think people kind of know who you are, and you're, of course, iconic from your commercials. But if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself and saying a little bit about who you are and what you're up to.
Thank you. Well, my name is George Zimmer, and after starting Men's Warehouse in 1973 and getting fired in 2013, I decided that I was too young to retire, so I've started two new companies, although they're, we call them sister companies, and they're very synergistic. One is Generation Tux, which is an online tuxedo rental business. And then the other business is called Z Tailors, and it's an on-demand tailor network, much like Uber, in which we would dispatch using technology, tailors to people's homes or offices to do tailoring. And of course, when you're renting tuxedos online, the first thing most people ask is, well, that's great, but how do you get it to fit? So that's why we have Z Tailors to solve that problem.
So I see why they're sister companies. They really work together.
Right.
You're in an interesting space, actually. My husband and I just went to a formal event last week, and he ended up buying a suit, but I rented my dress and went through a company that sent me several different sizes, and I didn't want to go out and buy a formal gown, and so one came to my house 2 days before the event, and I had time to try them on and send back what I didn't need. And it's really a neat take on an old business to have it be so convenient and sort of technologically integrated.
Sounds like Rent the Runway.
Exactly. That's what it was.
I know Jennifer, and I think she's got a great business model.
Yeah. So you've been an entrepreneur for a long time. You've, 43 years of time running companies, founding companies. And let's start out with the good stuff. What are you most proud of as you think about your first act and now your second act being an entrepreneur?
Well, in my first company, I think what I was most proud of was that while we were dominating our sector financially in terms of Wall Street, we were voted one of the 100 best companies to work for 10 years in a row, a vote that is compiled mostly from employee interviews.
What made Men's Warehouse a good place to work?
Well, we had a very powerful corporate culture. Nobody was getting rich, so it certainly wasn't that. It was that people really liked coming to work. And as I found out over the years, not that this was part of the original intent, but people really liked the idea, even though we were a New York Stock Exchange company, they felt like they were working for an individual, George. So it changed the employee's experience.
So how did you cultivate that kind of intimate or connected company culture, given that you had stores all over the U.S. and Canada?
Well, I think the real answer is it was easy. All I had to do was be my authentic self, and anybody can be their authentic self. What does that mean? Well, it means that I invited Deepak Chopra to be on the board of directors. It means that I publicly supported Occupy Wall Street. It means that I was friends with Wayne Dyer, who you know has just passed away, and used to cite at training classes from books that either Wayne or Deepak or other New Paradigm authors were writing, knowing that my workforce, retail clerks, were unlikely going to read the books. So I, in effect, read them for them and then presented the highlights in training classes. I'll give you an example. One of Wayne's, I think, best books, you may have read it, was entitled Real Magic. And in that book, he had this phrase, which became a phrase that I used repeatedly inside my company, and I've used it throughout my life. And it really is very simple. It is that the paradigm has shifted from I'll believe it when I see it to I'll see it when I believe it. That, by the way, did not go over well with my senior executives. And thus I came up with George's first corollary of management, which is the more income you have, the less likely you are to believe the new paradigm.
There's sort of a long history of tension between philosophical or religious ways of thinking and good old-fashioned money.
Historically, there has been, but I'm trying to change that in my new company by on social media, which really didn't exist when I had my other career. I'm writing about what I'm calling conscious capitalism. But that's just my language. There are many ways you can describe it. Sometimes it's called the triple bottom line. Some people refer to it as a B Corp. It's the idea that corporations are given charters because they have to do more than generate profits for the shareholders. I like to describe it in terms of the difference between shareholders and stakeholders. Shareholders are stakeholders, but so are the employees, the customers, the suppliers, and the communities.
So what else would you like your company to accomplish in addition to being profitable? Like, what else is on your social agenda or your desire for your company?
Well, one of our partners is Salesforce.com. In fact, we launched Generation Tux at Dreamforce. It's probably still online. It was a 45-minute tech presentation, the likes of which has probably not happened too often. And Marc Benioff, who's the founder of Salesforce, is a friend of mine, and the model that he's used, which I think makes sense, is what he calls 1-1-1, which means that a company puts 1% of its equity into a foundation, donates 1% of its profits into said foundation, and reimburses employees for 1% of their time, which they are asked to volunteer.
Okay, so there's kind of a structure that you're building into the way that your company is set up to have kind of a social enterprise or conscious capitalism.
Correct. But really, I think that when you ask what social purpose the company is serving, my hope is that, unlike in my first company, this company will truly manifest conscious capitalism and become an example for other entrepreneurs, other people in startups, other C-suite executives of large companies, that you can make money and treat people well at the same time. It's not mutually exclusive.
How do you think these particular values developed within you? Where did this come from for you? Spiritual tradition, family tradition?
Well, I think most things originate with your family, and more specifically your mother. My mother, who passed away 30 years ago when she was only 60, never had a paying job in her life, but was never home from school when I came home either. She donated her time to a myriad of New York area where we grew up institutions, including her passion, which was called Vacation Camp for the Blind, an opportunity for blind people to have social experiences. From having a mom like that and then going to college in the 60s, it didn't take a lot from me to learn what the counterculture represented. And before I actually began Men's Wearhouse, 3 years after I graduated college, I wanted to make sure that I would be comfortable as a capitalist, because as you probably know, in the 60s, people were not always infatuated with capitalists, and sometimes referred to them as capitalist pigs.
So you wanted to make sure that you could stay true to your family tradition and your values of service and still enter the business world.
Right. I didn't know, you know, as a young man, whether it was really compatible. And shortly after I went into business, I came upon a guy named Robert Greenleaf, who wrote about a leadership style called servant leadership. This is his idea. And we adopted that as our leadership model. It very simply is you define success in terms of your ability to create success for the other people, not just yourself.
And I'm guessing that some of these distinctive values contributed to the end of your time at Men's Wearhouse. Am I guessing correctly?
Oh, absolutely. Even though each of the directors I personally solicited and considered them friends, one was a friend of mine going back to school days. He'd been a friend for 50 years. So this was really, from my point of view, a betrayal.
Was it a surprise to you?
Well, it wasn't a complete surprise, but I think that when they actually said in a board of directors meeting, my services were no longer needed, and then said, and we have put your furniture and personal possessions in storage, that really shocked me, since I had founded the company, made most of these people successful. Well, they were successful, but they liked having Men's Wearhouse on their resume. I thought it was kind of classic old style capitalism, where CEOs are escorted out by security, even though I wasn't the CEO. I'd already turned that over to a man I had hired as our neckwear buyer 18 years earlier.
So there was a little bit of drama to it that seemed incongruent with the kind of trusting and connected relationships that you had thought that you had had.
I'm a Scorpio, so I like drama. Yeah, it was quite, you know, after you do something for your entire life, it becomes part of you. So even though I've been out now 2.5 years, earlier this year, I was in New York on a business trip. I was being driven around Manhattan by an Uber doing actual interviews like this. I had to use a restroom, and I saw a Men's Wearhouse store and ran in. My assistant at that time, without my even knowing it, followed me in and was videotaping this or recording it on her iPhone. And when I came out of the restroom, the tailor in the tailor shop saw me and started sobbing and embracing me. It was something that if you're not part of men's culture, you probably wondered what really was going on, two men embracing. But that was the nature of the bond that had been created. And I can still say that I had a mutual love affair with the store employees at Men's Warehouse.
Is there anything that you wish you had done differently now that you have the benefit of retrospect?
I feel almost stupid when I say, no, I don't think so. I feel like I should have learned. But really what I found was I went home that evening. I have two school-age children, and it was very quiet at dinner. Nobody wanted to talk to Dad, who had just been fired. And, you know, we had and still enjoy a very nice lifestyle. And I turned to my children and to my wife and said, everybody gets knocked down in life, no matter who you are. And the measure of a person is really what you do after you get knocked down. How do you get back up, get back in the game? So the reason I don't say, no, I would have done it things differently, is I'm actually relishing this opportunity to demonstrate, not just to my own family, but to anybody that's paying attention to my life, how to overcome obstacles.
What's been the hardest thing about being fired?
The hardest thing? Well, you know, they thought when they really wanted me to be chairman emeritus, a figurehead position. And they thought that the hook for that was that Men's had a company jet. And once you fly private, they didn't think I could go back to commercial. So my very first flight after being let go was a Southwest flight, and I was late. I was not at that time aware of Business Express, and I ended up in a middle seat on a completely full Southwest flight. And I remember laughing out loud in my seat because of how silly I had been to think that having access to a private plane was in any way, shape, or form necessary. It's merely a lovely convenience and a nice perk, but anybody who gets used to it and can only travel that way, I feel sorry for.
Or you were reminded, perhaps, of your own flexibility in the midst of this.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not, so I'm trying to think what has been the toughest part. You know, the toughest part is that I had hundreds of friendships, thousands of acquaintances at Men's Warehouse that were quite suddenly severed.
You used the word betrayal earlier. That's a heavy word.
It is. It's from Dante's Inferno, the bottom level of hell. Lucifer is frozen in a lake. And standing on either side of him are Brutus and Cassius. And there's a circle called Betrayal of Benefactors. By the way, I didn't know that until after I was fired. I had not read Dante's Inferno previously.
It gave you a picture to match what you were experiencing.
Well, I had read Julius Caesar in school, so I A to Brute. I had that exact experience emotionally. And when I watched the first Jobs film that came out a year or two ago, that scene in his boardroom where he was let go, Ashton Kutcher, I was just fascinated watching that scene.
I mean, this is one of my smushy psychological questions, but I wonder now that it's been a couple years, has there been any reconciliation or forgiveness with any of those people, or is it still pretty painful and broken in those relationships?
No, all the relationships are severed, and there has been no contact with any of them. And I do not miss it today. And quite frankly, the part of the reason this all came to pass was not just my liberal tendencies, but I had lost my love of going to work, primarily because I wasn't enjoying the people I was working with. The people I liked worked in the stores, not in headquarters. So it wasn't that upsetting to me. It's been, I think, far more difficult for the thousands of men and women who are still at Men's Warehouse working paycheck to paycheck in the stores week to week without any options. They have no choice. They need a job. Most of them, particularly those that had been there for a decade along or longer, which was many, were making good money and could not replace it. So I really feel for them because their job experience is diametrically opposite from what it was before.
I think it's really important to be able to talk about this because so many founders fear this very thing happening. It's one of the things that causes, I think, some anxiety for founders, particularly as they begin to be really successful. But I think it's so helpful to hear about the experience of losing it, of being removed from your company, being asked to leave, and still picking yourself up, and life keeps going, and there are other things you're doing that are important to you. I'm glad that you have been open and talking about it. I think it's important for entrepreneurs to hear.
I have spoken at a friend of mine who teaches at the Stanford Graduate Business School, and he teaches a class and wrote a book called Power: Why Some Have It and Some Don't. His name is Jeff Pfeffer, P-F-E. Anyways, I've spoken at his class more than once because I'm one of the few people that doesn't have a problem talking about losing power. And what I've said to his students, and the reason I interrupted you is because your husband and you speak to startups. And I think it's important to note this distinction. When you start a company, you have what I call authentic power. If you work in a big company, then you have organizational power. So an example would be if you work in a company and you're looking for a mentor, don't find the person you most resonate with. Find the most powerful person who will agree to be your mentor. Because business is more about power than about competence. I mean, I think most people realize that the smartest person is usually not the boss.
How are you changing things in your new ventures? What are you doing differently? What are you doing the same? What does it look like to do this again?
Well, you know, you weren't born. I've got your picture here. You were born when I started my first company. But the best difference is to look at the technology. To begin with, my new company is really the intersection of high tech and high touch. But my first company, when I opened my first store in 1973, my cash register was an NCR mechanical cash register, where when you pushed on the button up in the window, you could get no sale. You've probably never seen cash registers like that. It predates electronic or digital technology. So there has been this massive change in technology, and I'm not a technophile. So I've now brought in a real technology guru. Unfortunately, he wasn't my first hire, but he's with us now and he's great. And we've created a website. I don't know if you've looked at the Generation Tux website, but it's really, I mean, you would actually be more qualified to comment on it than I would, because it's targeted for millennials and actually millennial women, because weddings are really what drive tuxedo rentals. Are you in New York, by the way?
No, I'm in California.
Okay. I asked because I'm going to be marrying the first couple in the United States at Times Square this New Year's Eve.
You're going to be marrying them?
Yes. I've just got my minister license.
Fantastic. Well, I'm assuming you know where to get a tux.
I do. I have it. By the way, we also are renting suits, because 20% of formal weddings now, people wear suits instead of tuxedos. And I do have some experience in the category.
Yes, I would say so. So you mentioned having school-aged kids. What's it been like to be on this ride and have a family, have children? How have you kept your relationships healthy through the ups and downs of your journey?
I saw that question and, you know, Sherry, I said, well, you know, should I answer that honestly or construct some wonderful fantasy land? But
hey, earlier you pitched yourself with authenticity, so, you know.
That's right. And so that's why I'm going to tell you the truth. I've been married twice. I have 4 children, 2 of each flavor. And I would not say that I am anywhere near as good at being a husband and father as I am at being an entrepreneur and CEO. And I'm not proud to say that. I'm just speaking the truth.
That's just what it is. And it sounds like, you know, I think women often feel this pressure of trying to balance everything, you know, to be successful in their careers and be mothers and keep a nice house and stay skinny and all of that stuff. I don't think men are that immune from that pressure either. And I think we're not all good at everything.
Yeah. I mean, we talked earlier about spirituality as opposed to religion. Years ago, I learned that I was far from perfect and that my life would be much more enjoyable if I did not try to be perfect, recognizing that I'm not good in everything. And there are things I'm better in than others, and to allow myself to make mistakes and to not be fearful, because I think that fear is what actually holds back most people from self-actualizing.
So to not be afraid of not being good at something or not be afraid of failing, whether that's personally or professionally.
Right. I mean, our culture has made it so distasteful, although it's a perception, not so much a reality, but the perception of failure as maybe we should say it humorously, failure is overrated. You're a psychologist. You know this.
I do. And the more we try to protect ourselves and our children from failure, the worse our mental health gets. We don't know how to recover if we don't practice failing.
And I try to teach this to my children as well. My second son, who still lives at home, just passed his driver's permit test yesterday, not the driving test, the written test.
Yes.
He is now driving a car with mom and dad. So I'm now beginning the process of explaining how failure relates to driving a car.
Well, good luck. Good luck to him and to you.
Thank you.
So I know we probably just have a couple more minutes, but as you reflect on all of your experience, what wisdom or piece of legacy do you pass on to the generation of entrepreneurs that's coming behind you?
I'm going to be 67 in 3 weeks. And I can say authentically that I don't feel I've ever worked a day in my life. I've enjoyed what I've done. And I think whether you're starting a new business or you have a job in a company, you should think about at the end of your life, or I don't think I'm at the end, in the last quarter of your life, will you be able to say that you feel like you've never worked a day in your life? You've had such a great ride. And that's really, I think, what it's about is, you know, the Dalai Lama, I think, understands this. We grow from childhood to adulthood, and most of that is fantastic. But we do lose some of our childhood wonder and awe at the simple things in life. And life can include that even when you become the Dalai Lama, 80 years old. He giggles like a little kid still.
So in some ways you're talking about playfulness and joy.
Yeah.
That the work can be work and still be joyful and still feel like play, at least sometimes, at least a chunk of the time.
My biggest complaint of millennials is that as a generation, you seem to have lost your sense of humor.
Oh, not all of us.
Not everybody, of course. I'm stereotyping. But, and of course, I guess it's not as easy to be funny when an entire generation isn't certain that they can do better than their parents materially. But that's really the trap. You probably won't do better than your parents materially, but you'll do better than your parents emotionally, spiritually, and in your relationships.
And those are the things that at the end of your life may be most important to measure.
I think so.
That kind of success. Well, George, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I appreciate your authenticity and openness, and I'm excited about your new ventures, and I know where to go next time my husband needs a suit.
Yeah, you know, I'm working on an idea for next year because I'm looking at your husband's picture, and he doesn't look like he's wearing suits to go to work, only to go out and party. So I'm opening up next year the Suit of the Month Club, which, of course, is a takeoff on Harry and David's Fruit of the Month Club. But the idea occurred to me that, much like the Netflix model, millennial men don't need to own their suits. They can just rent them and trade them in like movies when they want a new one. So it's something we're looking at right now.
That's fantastic. We've talked before on the podcast about some of our generation's value toward not accumulating a lot of stuff. So any sort of idea that lets men look good without having to have a closet full of stuff to lug around, I'm a fan of.
All right. I'll make a note of that. When it opens, we'll send you an email.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks so much, George. And we'll send you an email when this goes live. And it's been fabulous to talk with you.
Nice talking with you, Sharon.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder.
We'll be back next week with another conversation about how to enjoy a little bit more Zen in your startup life.